Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have the U.S. Senate and its powers evolved over more than 200 years? And would the Founding Fathers even recognize the upper chamber of the legislature as it exists today? Richard A. Baker was the first person to fill the position of official Senate historian. He held the post for more than 30 years until his retirement in 2009, researching the origins of the institution's long-held traditions and documenting important events into the modern era. In that capacity, Baker provided assistance to the late Neil McNeil of Washington Week and Time magazine as he worked on a comprehensive history of the Senate, and ultimately Baker took the project over himself after McNeil died in 2008. The final result of that joint effort is a new book called The American Senate, An Insider's History, and Richard Baker is here now to talk about it. Richard, welcome to Think.
Richard Baker's very happy to be with you this afternoon.
I wonder if you would start, before we get into the history of itself, talking about how the position was created. I mean, if this started in 1975, I would imagine you spent the first several years of your career with the Senate in catch-up mode.
It's sort of explaining what it was that a historical office is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. We were beneficiaries of the Watergate era.
Yeah.
The Senate sort of feeling its oats, feeling as if, the president had kind of pushed Congress around too much and that the Senate had its own traditions, but didn't know very much about those traditions. And here was the Senate sort of demanding that the State Department in the executive branch turn over records related to the Nixon presidency and foreign relations in general. And so historian Arthur Schlesinger wrote to Mike Mansfield, the Senate Majority Leader, and said, well, what are you guys doing? You know, you're telling the executive branch they should open up, but what about your records? The Defense Department and the State Department have had historians for many years. And so Mike Mansfield, the Senate Majority Leader, said, hey, you know, this is a guy that was formerly had taken graduate training in history, and he said, the time has come for us, as we're feeling good about ourselves as a Senate, to create a historical office so we can know a little bit more about our past.
And you were there at precisely the right time to make the transition from everything being right on paper and stored in file boxes to a lot of documents existing, I would imagine, mostly or solely in digital form.
Exactly so. It's one of the most important functions. It's evolved, as you suggest, into something we never would have anticipated. But when a senator leaves office after, say, 30 years, there's a dangerous temptation to throw away all those papers and erase all those electronic files. And we have, the Senate Historical Office has a staff of archivists who get in there ahead of time and say, not so quick, Senator, and not so quick, staff. Here's what you need to do. And it really has worked. It took a while, but it's now the record for the public to see is a lot richer than it would have been otherwise.
Time was that there weren't really professionalized staffs available to senators.
Within the Senate, or professionalized staff, it took the historical office a while to build its own professionalized staff of archivists and historic preservation specialists. And they would seek out people in senators' offices who seemed to have similar interests. And in some cases, we couldn't find anybody. So basically, I would go in and talk to groups of senators or their key aides and say, look, this is what you need to do. And if you don't believe me, I'm going to call up your state archivist and have your state archivist get on the phone to you and explain it to you in terms of your state's interest. And that, you know, it hasn't worked every time, but it really has been very helpful overall.
Richard, what makes the U.S. Senate so much more powerful than upper legislative chambers in other Western democracies?
One thing, I think, and that is that unlike other upper chambers, where, the lower chamber passes a bill and sends it to the upper chamber, and the upper chamber says, this doesn't look too good to us. We don't think we go along with it. Then the lower chamber will say, thank you very much, but it's going to be passed. in the Senate, it has to be passed in identical language. Mm-hmm. And that, more than anything else, gives the Senate its power.
So talk about the concerns that the founders had about the speed with which the House might act and the sort of lack of deliberation that played into the way they set up the Senate to be a very different body.
It was the number one concern. They were fearful of a body that was elected by the majority of people.
That sounds so funny for a fledgling democracy. That's right, exactly.
That would be stampeded into certain kind of legislation. I mean, we only have to think back to 9/11. You know, the national outrage and passing legislation very quickly. And then you think, well, maybe there's a time for a sober second thought. And that's really what the Senate does. You know, there's the old story about George Washington explaining to Thomas Jefferson why they created a Senate at the Constitutional Convention. He said it's for the same reason that you just poured your hot tea into the saucer to cool it. And so we're pouring the hot tea of House legislation into the senatorial saucer. We don't know if he really said that, but it works as a good story.
It's a good metaphor, yeah. So when the Senate, of course, first convened, there were, only 22 members?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So they didn't, worry about filibusters because half of them were out sick or still riding on their horses or stagecoaches to the capital city, and so everybody could speak as long as he wanted, and I emphasize he. Took a long while for women to come to the Senate.
So the smaller size made it easier, certainly, for members to deliberate carefully. And there are also issues of senators have to be older at a minimum when they enter. Was that another thing that the founders thought would mean that senators were a little wiser, had a little more gravitas than congressmen?
I think so. I think they were using the Roman Senate as sort of at least an indistinct model. That these would be the wisest of the wise, and you would 30 years old in 1787 when they were drafting the Constitution was pretty old by today's standards.
Sure.
With the average life expectancy for many people no more than 45 years.
What makes the Senate so adamant about the preservation of traditions? And then how long did it take for early practices to be viewed as sort of inviolable traditions, given that, for a while everything was new, even in the U.S. Senate?
Of course, the Senate didn't create all of this from whole cloth.
Right, right.
They really did pay attention to what state senates were doing, as well as the Continental Congress. It is always, since it's a body that represents the states equally rather than the people equally, there's always been a concern for the rights of all the states, which leads then to a veneration of tradition. This is the way we've done it in the past. We want to avoid any dramatic new procedures because, indeed, it might work against the rights of individual states. And senators from those states, from all of the states, didn't take them long to figure out, how they could really stop the machine from moving to protect themselves.
One tradition that has changed is our ability as voters to directly elect the senators who will represent us, and that happened only a century ago.
And yet, the first move to amend the Constitution began in 1826.
So why did it take so long?
I think the House kept passing the constitutional amendment, and the Senate said, no, actually, we think it's easier to run for re-election or to run for election for the first time by just going to the state legislature. And in some cases, the state Senate may have only had 26 members, and so all you need is 14 of those 26 to vote for you. And if you need a little money to help them make up their minds, it wasn't all that expensive. So it was really the relatively small size and the reachability of the state legislatures that just made it easier and more convenient. And it took a while for a major national outcry, particularly in the so-called progressive era movement around 1910. One of the major planks was direct popular election of the senators. Why shouldn't senators be elected by the people?
And when you say if you need a little money to persuade those 14 that it might take to choose you, you're being quite literal there. You're not talking about campaign posters.
No, no.
There were houses purchased. This system was sort of ripe for corruption.
It really was, that's true. In one case that we know of, a candidate for the Senate was going around saying, "I'll pay your mortgage for you. You know, whatever it takes." And this particularly happened in the 1880s and the 1890s, when there were huge fortunes out there to be tapped, and slowly but surely, some of the people who possessed those fortunes decided they would like to be in the Senate because maybe they could help make laws that would be even more sympathetic to their industries. So it got to be absolutely out of control, and the House, as I said, passed the constitutional amendment on a number of occasions. There was a racial issue involved. Southern senators in the 1890s, 1900, didn't like the thought that African Americans would be allowed to vote. And so I think that you don't find this in writing, but I think that was a major reason for slowing it down. But by 1910, the Jim Crow laws were in such good effect from the point of view of the Southern racists that they knew that African Americans weren't going to be able to vote anyway. There would be literacy tests and one thing or another, and so they let it go through.
So how did things start to change once senators felt themselves accountable to the general population of voters? Did the way they deliberated, the decisions they made, start to shift?
They did, very slowly. They began to play to their constituencies. We're such a far cry from, say, 1914, the first election under direct election, as compared with today. Members back then would go back to their states maybe two or three times a year. And, of course, Congress is in session only a relatively small period of time. When they would go home, they'd go around and they'd speak at local meetings. But I should add one thing, and that is that nothing in the Senate happens overnight, including the direct election of senators. Throughout the period leading up to the ratification of the 17th Amendment, and I'm thinking of the periods from the 1870s, the 1880s, and 1890s, various states sort of pioneered their own system of electing senators. And they would, at an election, they would say, "Here are the candidates that are going to run for Senate. What do you think about these candidates?" And then the people would vote, and then they would present the results of those votes to the state legislature. And they would say, "Here's what the people want. And if you're, if you're not willing to go along with that, then everybody's going to know that." So slowly but surely, the popular pressure really eroded the original intent of the framers to keep the election of senators out of the hands directly of the people.
You think, this is better the way we do it today? Are you willing to?
Well, there are people who suggest we should go back to the old way, but that old way really was a seedbed for bribery and corruption, shady practices of the worst order. Senate spent a lot of its time debating the credentials of senators who came under sort of tarnished conditions. But today we have another problem, and that is the vast amounts of money it takes in a media-driven world to campaign for a Senate seat.
I am sure we will talk more about that after this quick break. My guest is Richard A. Baker. He's former official historian of the United States Senate and co-author of the new book, The American Senate, An Insider's History. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the former official historian of the United States Senate, Richard A. Baker. His new book, co-authored by the late Neil McNeil, is called The American Senate, An Insider's History. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So, Richard, just before the break, you brought this up, and it is certainly a key feature of being a senator today, the money it takes to get elected. Now, even as recently as half a century ago, it wasn't that expensive, relatively speaking, to get into one of these offices.
Exactly right. Depending, of course, on what state you were from, small states like Vermont and Nevada, it was pretty easy to raise the few hundred or maybe few thousand dollars. That as late as 1968. But since that time, it's just skyrocketed.
And that also requires that senators not only spend more money on, you know, ads and things like that, but they're going back and forth a lot more often to their districts.
They are indeed. It was one of the invention of the jet aircraft, jet airplane, really changed senators' lives, because whether they wanted to fly across the country to their home states once or twice a week or not, their voters, constituents, knew that they could. Mm-hmm. And so they're always on the road, and it is a tremendous way to fragment your attention. You're always being pushed and pulled, and today's senators are surrounded by a protective wall of staff members. It's a whole different game.
And it certainly cuts down on the opportunity for attending, say, a bipartisan barbecue or ball game or something that might build camaraderie across the aisle.
Exactly so. When I first started in the Senate Historical Office in 1975, most senators had homes in the Washington, D.C. area. And they spent weekends and evenings with other senators and their families. They get to know the name of the not only the other senators' children, but even the names of their pets. And it's irrespective of what party they happen to belong to. And it's pretty hard to stand up on the floor of the Senate and really attack somebody who you just went to a potluck dinner with. But that's all changed just within the last, 10, 15 years. Now senators rarely have permanent homes in the Washington, D.C. area. That was always a kiss of death in a campaign. Oh, look at this person. He's abandoned our state and now living in Washington.
Yeah, that's right. Suddenly you're a Washington insider, which is the last thing you want to be if you want to get reelected.
Even more so now than, say, 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the rivalry, the cooperation, the competition between the House and the Senate over time.
Well, and we do devote a chapter to that subject in the book, and you could write a whole book on it for sure. The senators look down on House members, and they primarily because they have a lot more power. An individual senator has a lot more power than an individual House member.
Sure.
In that a senator can, the Senate operates by unanimous consent. The most routine action, like we want to take up this bill tomorrow, all it takes is one senator to say, "I object," and that stops everything. Whereas in the House is a majority-based institution, so nobody cares about minority members in the House if at least nobody in the majority cares about them. Whereas in the Senate, you've got to convince the minority that your particular amendment or bill is something that might be of interest to them as well.
So there is that sort of relationship, and then there's the issue of hammering out legislation once one body or the other has decided on it, and they have sort of had different strategies over the years of trying to come to consensus between the two houses.
They do indeed. House members when it comes to the members of the House and the Senate sitting down to hammer out a compromise version between the bills that one passed and the bills that the other passed, House members always had the upper hand because a House member is assigned to a lot fewer committees than a senator and therefore has the opportunity to develop some really deep expertise in the subject matter on the table, whereas senators are always kind of moving around from, you know, three or four or five different committees. And so they always, you know, the House members always prevailed in that kind of a situation. Today, the House and the Senate have very few of those kinds of conferences, primarily because they are targets for filibusters. And so what they try to do is to pass a bill, then send it over to the Senate, and the Senate will say, no, we don't like that. So then the House repasses it in a version that the Senate can live with, and then they'll pass it so that they don't have to go to conference and therefore create an opportunity for even more filibusters. I mean, that's the sad state of how we are, where we are today.
So the filibuster is something that continues to worry people, but there's a long history of people being concerned that the filibuster was going to sort of bring down the ability of the Senate to get anything done.
That's true. Goes way back. But a memorable example was in 1925 when the new vice president came in on Inauguration Day, was sworn in the Senate chamber, and then was asked if he'd like to make a little speech. So he made a speech in which he said, we should get rid of the filibuster. We should make all of our decisions by majority vote. And senators looked around and to one another and they said, who invited him in? He's not a senator. We didn't elect him. We don't have to pay much attention, even though he, as vice president, is the presiding officer of the Senate. And they ignored him and sort of laughed him out of the chamber. So it didn't work.
Is it safe to call Huey Long king of the filibuster?
Yes, it is. And he was, not only was he the king, but he was also sort of the court jester. He was he made a filibuster interesting in that he would come up with all kinds of recipes to read into the record. And his personality was extremely charismatic. I mean, this is 1933, 34, 35. Franklin Roosevelt, as president, was afraid that Huey Long was going to run against him in 1936. And that he was a very dangerous man, because a lot of people were feeling that he was in favor of bringing the government closer to the people. And then, of course, Huey Long was assassinated in 1935, and that was the end of that.
Another absolutely fascinating chapter in the book is the chapter about the relationship between the presidency and the U.S. Senate. Certainly there has been sort of a tug of war going on for quite some time.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
That tug of war extends back to 1789, to President George Washington, where there were basic differences about what the Senate's role was in nominating, in confirming presidential nominations. And the president would say, "Well, these are the people I want as my cabinet secretaries. I ought to be able to have whom I want." And the Senate would say, yeah, pretty much, but we have a problem with this one guy. So they had some very hard feelings about that. Some of those hard feelings then continued over the years. But only remarkably, in terms of cabinet and executive branch nominations, only 9 cabinet secretaries have been rejected by the Senate during the whole 224-year history of the Senate. When it comes to Supreme Court nominations, however, or other judicial nominations, only about 1 in 5 has been rejected. So the Senate is saying, wait a minute, cabinet nomination goes away when the president goes away. But the judicial nominees, once they're in office, they're there for life. And we're going to take that a lot more seriously.
I was interested, a lot of contemporary analysts say that one of the failures of President Obama has been to create strong relationships in the Senate and the House. But as it turns out, you have a really great rundown of modern presidents, and they have sort of, some of them have been brilliant at making good relationships, and some have been poor at it.
That's true. John F. Kennedy, of course, was a senator, one of the only 3 people who went directly from the Senate to the White House, along with Warren Harding and Barack Obama. And the one thing that John F. Kennedy did was to hire a man named Larry O'Brien, to be a congressional liaison person once Kennedy got into the White House. And then his term, you know, of course, was cut short. But then Lyndon Johnson became a master. He still used Larry O'Brien. He used him even more than Kennedy did, realizing that the best way to govern effectively is to make sure that these fires don't start. Put out the fires as soon as you can. And the way to do that is to have one of your people on the Capitol Hill to try to provide whatever it is that this House member or senator thinks they need to make the problem go away.
It does seem that Lyndon Johnson was really born to be a legislator, maybe to a greater extent than he was born to be president.
I think that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that disputed box from Alice, Texas, in the 1948 election, where you know, we now know that it was a fraudulent result, what would have happened without a Lyndon Johnson? I mean, he really did expand the powers of the majority leadership, and even the minority leadership in the Senate. And today's Harry Reid, as the majority leader of the Senate, owes so much to Lyndon Johnson for expanding that office.
Why did Jimmy Carter have such a hard time communicating with the Senate?
Well, senators felt, and particularly Senate leaders, like Senator Robert Byrd, the majority leader at the time, felt that Jimmy Carter had his own agenda. And whether irrespective of what the Senate wanted to do, what the House wanted to do. He particularly had a lot of, he wanted to save money in funding water projects throughout the West. And so he put in his budget to cut all these water projects. Well, of course, he then made mortal enemies of the senators and representatives from those parts of the country who said, we're not going to stand still for that kind of action. So it took Jimmy Carter a while to learn how to negotiate, and if he ever did in his four-year term, I don't know.
Is there a particular tension when someone who has been senator becomes president? Do his his colleagues, because there's only been men until now,
right.
Do his colleagues have a sort of resentment? Is there a sense that, like, you're still one of us? Do you have a feel for that at all?
That's an excellent question. It, you know, the one where it should have worked would have been Lyndon Johnson, majority leader. He knew how to make the trains run on time. Then all of a sudden, in 1961, he became the vice president. And as I suggested earlier, the vice president really has no powers. He cannot even speak to the Senate without the Senate's permission. But then all of a sudden, he became president. And I think, indeed, senators did resent Lyndon Johnson early in his presidency. They certainly resented him when he was vice president and was trying to, he wanted to come back to Capitol Hill to preside over the caucus of Democratic senators. And senators said, you're not a senator anymore. You don't count. And LBJ felt that, and he was grievously offended by that. And basically went off and did other things.
Going back once again to the rules and traditions and points of order within the Senate, I was interested in the process by which freshman senators, some people call them baby senators, are sort of taught the ropes and given quite literally an orientation.
They are. And I start the book with a chapter that I witnessed in a closed-door briefing in 1996. And they're trying to be grown-ups. You know, they come in and they, you know, just dawning on them that they actually did win the election. But then they're also acting like third graders, opening the top of the desks in the Senate chamber and looking inside and wondering where the so-called candy desk is, where they can get candy while the Senate's in session. It takes a while to learn. I was going to say how to be a senator, but beyond that, what your powers are as a senator. It's easy to come to the Senate and make a lot of speeches and say, you know, I'm going to object to everything. And generally, other senators, more senior senators, really take a dim view of that. And after a while, senators kind of, the so-called baby senators kind of grow out of that posture, and particularly when they begin to get good committee assignments and they can really get involved in substantive legislation.
Well, the system of seniority is very, very interesting. There was just a piece yesterday on NPR talking about when then-Senator Obama went to visit some people. He talked about how he was ranked 99th. Now, there were not just two people elected that year. So talk about how ranking order works, seniority works in the Senate, because it's not only about when you were elected.
Exactly. Let's say that 10 new senators were elected in the most recent election. So how do you, in terms of assigning the most important thing, which is good office space, how do you rank? So basically, they rank according to previous service. If the senator had been a cabinet member or had been a member of the House, they get a few extra points than somebody who didn't have that kind of service. And then for everybody that's left over, it's basically the population of their state. So if you're number 99 or 100, you're sitting in the back row of the Senate chamber, you were called on last in many cases, and there are many ways that you were reminded that you are a neophyte.
And why is office space such a big deal? Everyone gets approximately the same resources, right?
Well, actually, it depends a lot on the size of your state.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know, a state like Texas or California gets a lot more resources because there are a lot more people to serve. But in fact, some states, I know for sure in the case of California, they automatically have certain offices set aside for them because they have much larger staffs than many of the other states. For the middle rank of senators, their offices are a lot farther away in the office buildings from the Senate floor. It takes them a while to get there, and if you have to go five times a day to vote on the floor of the Senate, you begin to notice how much shoe leather you're wearing out in the process.
Richard A. Baker is my guest. He's former official historian of the United States Senate and co-author, along with the late Neil McNeil, of the new book, The American Senate, An Insider's History. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard A. Baker. He is former official historian of the United States Senate and co-author of the new book, The American Senate, An Insider's History. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You write, Richard, that there are two kinds of senators. There are workhorses and there are show horses. I think we sort of know what those terms mean, but talk about how they differ with regard to what that means for their careers.
Well, if you take it from the perspective of a brand new senator coming in, it's like, you know, going to work in a new organization. Some people want to learn as much as they can about that organization before they go out and start taking a public position on various issues. And others are just more naturally inclined to you know, start giving speeches, at least in the context of the Senate, and not rolling up their sleeves and not doing the tremendous amount of homework that's necessary to be an effective senator. You just can't. There's also a contrast between committee senators and floor senators. Hmm. And the floor senators are the ones that are out there giving speeches, and the committee senators are the ones that are really trying to figure out tremendously complex issues and attending hearings and so forth. And it's almost as if, you know, it's just a personality type. You either go in one direction or the other. And the senators who ultimately will have the most power are the people who do their homework, just as you would say to a young person in school.
Is it possible to generalize an answer for this? Who are senators targeting when they make those floor speeches? We now have television cameras. C-SPAN is there, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But are they talking to their fellow lawmakers? Are they just wanting to get something into the congressional record? Who are they talking to?
They really are building the record.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get it into the record. Some of them will then turn it into reprints that they can pass out back in the state. In the chapter in the book on debate, we really try to struggle with the question: who pays attention? Or another way to put it: do speeches on the floor of the Senate change votes among other lawmakers? And you ask lawmakers if they've ever changed their mind because of a speech they've heard, and most of them kind of scratch their heads and say, maybe once or twice in my 30 years. So it's really building the record, and now with major media coverage, of course there's even more incentive to get out there and make a fiery speech for the folks back home.
Why did it take until the mid-80s for television cameras to be present during those deliberations?
Well, the opponents of it, and this is, what really pushed it was 1979. The House decided to allow cameras in to cover its proceedings from start to finish. And there were many stories of senators and House members going back to the home state, and the House member was recognized because of his or her appearances on C-SPAN, and senators were sort of in a dark hole. So that did it as much as anything else. But some of the other opponents also said that the rules of the Senate are so arcane and convoluted that it's going to make the Senate look awful on television. And they were probably right, as it turned out. Of course, they've dressed up the Senate chamber now so that senators who are junior, who sit up in the back row, it doesn't quite look like they're speaking from a bus station because they put in damask-patterned wall coverings and a lot more color in the chamber. They have upgraded the quality of the rug and the color. So but all that designed to make it a better television set.
Did they, Richard, start like dressing better and getting more haircuts once TV was always around?
That's what they thought was going to happen. And for the first couple of weeks, this started on June 2nd, 1986. And for the male senators all showed up in red ties and blue shirts. There weren't very many women senators at that point, they really did pay attention to their appearance, and then they tended to forget about it. But the real difference is everyone's decided, people have joked that the floor of the Senate looks like a motel seminar. Bring in the easels and the flip charts and use those as sort of teaching aids. It's hard to know whether that's contributed to the quality of the debate.
And in person, it's not actually a very big room, is it?
It's not. No, it's smaller than the House chamber by a long shot. Of course, they have to cram 440 people into the House chamber. But it is much smaller.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Dominic in Cedar Hill. Hello, Dominic.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Great. I had a question real quick. So when we had Reconstruction and African Americans were allowed to vote, we had several black senators. I was wondering how their white colleagues treated them.
Not well. Not well at all. The first black senators came from Mississippi, Hiram Revels and Blanche K. Bruce. They were shunned. They were insulted in a thousand different ways. There were senators who would stand on the floor and kind of ignore them and then launch into speeches that would curl your hair today in terms of the racial epithets. And no one called them to order. No one said that they were out of bounds. Then black senators were, African Americans were there only for a relatively short time. By 1901, there were no more, and it really then wasn't until well into the 20th century.
Speaking of not being called to order, how many times over the years have senators come to blows?
Well, there was a two famous times. Mm-hmm. One in 1856, when a House member came into the Senate chamber after they adjourned for the day around 12:30 in the afternoon, and walked up to Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. The House member was from South Carolina and took exception to a speech that Charles Sumner had made a few days earlier, and took a cane and beat him over the head, and the beating lasted for about a minute. Then the House member left and resigned from the House, and Charles Sumner had a headache for 3 years. And the Senate at that point decided to debate it, whether they should change the rules to say, this is not proper. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to, gentlemen should know this. So then in 1902, it happened again, where two South Carolina senators, I don't know why South Carolina has a fiery temper than other states, but one called the other one, his colleague from South Carolina, a liar. And so the offended senator, on the floor of the Senate, punched him in the mouth. And then there was they started rolling around on the floor, desk got knocked over. That's when, in 1902, the Senate finally added what is known today as Rule 19, that a senator shall not make remarks that are offensive to another senator or to that senator's state. And even today, when relations among senators are not particularly wonderful, we will hear senators saying, I want to invoke Rule 19, which means the senator has to stop speaking, sit down, and then his or her remarks are read back to him, and then the presiding officer decides whether it's offensive. It's almost like in a third-grade classroom.
A timeout, basically.
Exactly.
Senators famously refer to one another on the floor as my friend. Does that sort of courtesy etiquette, does that help to maintain a more civil tone, or is that sometimes it seems like it's just completely they're speaking through gritted teeth?
But you're exactly right. It was designed to maintain a more civil tone. So you never say you. You never turn and look at the other senator and point your finger at that senator. You're always speaking to the senator through the presiding officer. And that is believed to kind of lower the temperature of debate. But every once in a while, if you're listening in, when you start hearing the yous flying through the air, that the tempers are really elevated. And sometimes the presiding officer officers don't stop that. They let it go. Not a good situation.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you so much. Two quick things. Who would your guest say is the most who is the most effective senator he knows of who did not have a national profile? And what are his thoughts on how effective Texas U.S. Senator Lloyd Benson was? And I will hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
That's an excellent question. The first thing you have to do is define what you mean by effective. John F. Kennedy, when he was a senator, was in charge of a committee in the 1950s to name the five most effective senators so that they could paint their portraits in some vacant spaces in a reception room in the Capitol. They had a devil of a time trying to come up with effective senators. In response to your specific question, Mike Mansfield of Montana, who was majority leader of the Senate for 16 years, was effective. And then Howard Baker, the Republican from Tennessee, I thought was very effective. And there are others I could name, but what really characterizes their approach to the Senate was their civility, their willingness not only to speak but to listen and to know the difference. Texas has produced 33 senators since 1845 out of a total of 1948, and certainly starting with Sam Houston and a senator named Thomas Rusk, who was very well respected within the Senate. And you can go on to the internet and under go into the Senate website, and you will find something called Senate by States. And you click on Texas, and you'll get a list of every senator who served from Texas, biographical information, and anecdotes about their service.
And any particular thoughts on Lloyd Benson?
Thank you. I, of course, never had any personal dealings with him, but I thought that he was considered a very effective senator. There was a sense of, you know, people being sorry when he agreed to leave the Senate to become Secretary of the Treasury, that he was sort of part of the old school of, the wise men who listened and who would sort of help make deals in the back room, not on the front pages of the newspaper. So, yes, he leaves a good legacy.
We've hardly had time at all to talk about the Senate's work as an investigative body, but that is certainly something that they have used a lot more in recent years than they did early on in the body's history.
That's true. Although they were, even during the Civil War, they were trying out their investigative skills and driving Abraham Lincoln as president very crazy, because there were senators actually out on battlefields taking notes and interviewing generals in the middle of the war. But certainly the best of all investigations from the Senate's point of view was the Watergate investigation in 1973. Since that time, the Senate has not had such a great record in convening their own investigative committees. And what they've tended to do is farm it out, just like the 9/11 Commission. That was an outside organization, and it is the commissions make their reports, and then the reports lie on the shelf because there was no senator involved in the committee in the deliberations that led to that report, and therefore has no stake in making sure that the recommendations are implemented. So that's sort of a change over the last 20 or 30 years.
So you spent 34 years, Richard, as the official historian of the U.S. Senate. Were you able to discover a time ever in the history of the United States when Americans looked around, smiled and nodded at each other and said, this is the very best Senate we've ever had and the country's doing great?
I love that question. That is a wonderful question. No, as a matter of fact. No. But it's very good because you're right. I mean, it's sort of the attitude is, these people are taking our money and they're giving it to other states and they're all feathering their own nests and we can't trust them very much, although we tend to like our own senator. Mm-hmm. Although in these days, people aren't even liking their own senators very much. But right, it can be a thankless job if you take it seriously.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a good thing that maybe it's never things aren't ever as bad as we think they might be.
That's right, exactly.
Richard A. Baker served as the official historian of the U.S. Senate from 1975 until 2009. His new book, written with the late Neil McNeil of Washington Week and Time magazine, is called The American Senate and Insider's History. Richard, what a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris, for your great questions.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the Freak podcast at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome your comments, your questions, and your suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.